You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China, and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray, and you get a whole service just on
it. How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
Well, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. Today we continue our summer series, replaying some of our best interviews and segments from past shows. Earlier this year we spoke to Simon Pierce from Symbian Health about their move to Microsoft's new server operating system, Windows Server 2008. We'll be replaying that interview later in the show. We'll also hear from Michael Cremian of Audacious Productions, an expert in audio production who, among other things, will help us unravel some of the mysteries of a home cinema sound system. However, first up, we're talking about an issue that affects almost all computer or technology users sooner or later. How to get your stuff back when it all goes wrong. Graham Henley is a director of Get Data Software, co-developer of their leading data recovery software, and one of the world's foremost experts in the field of data recovery. He joined the panel back in May last year and provided some fascinating insights into what we can do when it all comes unstuck. So thanks for joining us again in this summer series of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Graham Callaghan, and I'll be back on the panel when we return in February with all new shows. But right now, here's Andrew McCollum, Dr. Ron, Justin Dunlop and myself on the panel speaking with Get Data's Graham Henley.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McCollum here. Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan and Jason Dunlop all here. Present and accounted this evening. It's very nice having everybody in the studio. It makes a great change.
Nice and cosy.
It is, isn't it?
Mm.
Anyway, data backup. Have you had a crisis, Dr. Ron, where you've gone, oh no, and you've gone, oh, this is a problem?
No, data recovery is overrated. We don't really need to. No. I jest. It's very, very important. And we all have, everyone who's worked in the industry is all, well, I think we've all experienced that horrible, just about to have a car crash feeling.
Yeah,
you've just discovered that something very, very bad's happened in a data loss sense, and you just suddenly
your hardness makes that clunk sound.
You have a lot of customers, I would have thought, that have been down that.
I've had customers, but I've been there myself as well, not just customers.
Well, we have Graham Henley on the phone. He's from a company called Get Data. You can visit his website, getdata.com.au. But Graham's had many years' experience in recovering data. In fact, he's done it professionally for organisations like the Australian Federal Police. So if someone knows how to recover stuff off a drive, I would think it'd be this man. Graham, you've had plenty of years' experience in this sort of stuff, I can gather.
Hello, gents. Yes, I've been doing data recovery work in various forms for probably about 15 years now.
And tell me about the, I guess, from a personal point of view, you'd probably be looking at developing software to help the mums and dads, the small businesses, potentially the large businesses, to get their software back when you hear those funny noises or you accidentally erase it too. I guess that's probably one of the problems too.
Yes, look, that's what my company does now. Get Data was formed as a software development company. So for a living, we go to work each day and we write software. And really, from my background and the background of some of the partners that I work with, it really came from that data recovery field. So when we first started the company, that was the basis. We sat down and we wrote some data recovery software that was could be used by the home user, the mums and dads, quite straightforwardly. If they have a disaster, like they delete files or format their hard drive or something goes wrong with their hard drive, it enables the home user or business users to get their data back.
Is it really that simple? Is it really easy to do it? Because there's a lot of different sort of parameters, I would have thought, to actually pull data back off a drive, especially if you've erased it or the machine's making some strange noises.
Yeah, look, it's It ranges from some very simple things can go wrong with a hard drive to enable you to lose the data, right to some very complex things. And when you talk about data recovery, there's really two types. There's data loss that can be solved with a software solution, and then there's your physical hardware recovery, which is when your hard drive is a mechanical device. It's like a car. It gets old and it wears out. And so when you have physical problems, that's when you actually need to send your hard drive out to a service place that will start replacing those components and getting the data off the drive that way.
Graham, what can we do if we make a really simple, stupid, dumb mistake? If we suddenly delete 500 photographs of our children and our family and realise that we've got that setting turned off that says put things in the recycle bin, and just suddenly we think, oh, no, you get that terrible sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach. I've just deleted everything. What's the very first thing that people should be doing in order to try and recover that data?
Well, essentially, the best thing to do is not to panic, because the data is still out there on the drive.
His famous last words.
Well, the principle of data recovery. Essentially, when Bill Gates sat down, he wrote Microsoft Windows. The way he wrote Windows was so that everything happens really quickly. No one wants to be sitting around waiting for things to happen on your computer. So really, at the start of any sort of storage disk, there's this table. And in the newer operating systems, they call it the master file table. And it's basically like a big spreadsheet that points out to where all the files are on the disk. So when you're in Windows and you actually delete a file, all you're really doing is going to that spreadsheet and saying, let's remove that entry. It's like tearing the index out of a book. But you can actually still go out to the data on the drive and still find it out there on the drive and recover it. So the most important thing is don't panic and don't start writing information to the drive, because as soon as you start changing the contents of the hard drive, then there's a good chance you could write data on top of some of the deleted material, and once it gets overwritten, then it's gone for good.
So what can we do, Graeme? Is there software that we need to have pre-installed to in anticipation of this sort of situation, or is this something that we can do straight away?
Yeah, our software is called Recover My Files. You can go to recovermyfiles.com and download it. And it's really designed so that after a data loss, or you can preempt this thing by having Recover My Files installed in the first instance, but it can be installed after a data loss and used just as effectively. So you download the software. It allows you to run it on your computer, and it goes through its various types of recovery searches that it does, and in the results screen it brings up the results, and it shows you in the results screen and enables you to click on the files that are found and preview the content. And once you can preview those pictures and you can preview the documents and read those things that you've lost, then you know your data's out there and you know it can be recovered.
Graham, I've had cause to recover in previous times, and the methods that I've used seem to take a long time, and it presents a lot of information which you go, my goodness, what is abc123.tmp type sort of files? Your software, is it still cumbersome like that, or are we starting to streamline it and say, well, the ones which are partially erased, I can't recover those, but here are the ones that I can get back? What's the sort of process? Does it take a long time still to recover a drive?
It can take a long time. It really depends on the depth of search you do. When I mentioned there's that spreadsheet at the start of the disk, it's very fast to go out to that spreadsheet, look for the deleted files that spreadsheet contains, and bring them all back. That search can be done, and a drive that's been accidentally formatted, for example, you can have that drive completely back within 15 minutes of searching. Now, when you go further down the depths of searching, you can go right down to a very tiny storage unit, a sector level, and then you can scan an entire disk at a sector level looking to dig up every last fragment of information that's on there. Now, if you're searching a terabyte drive at a sector level, it's going to take a long time, there's no doubt about it. So it really depends on the type of search you do. In our software, Recover My Files, we concentrated heavily on getting the preview capability in there. So when you run the search, you know what is on there can be found, because you can actually see the photos and the documents in front of you.
So, Graham, just taking a different approach, I deal with secondhand computers a fair bit, and if I'm going to sell one of my hard drives or one of my computers, how many do I need to zero level my drive, or is there some process I need to do to ensure that people can't recover data?
Yeah, look, there is a process. It's very, very important. If you're recycling a drive or handing a drive off to friends or basically, you know, getting rid of some sort of electronic storage media, you really have to protect yourself by wiping the drive. I mentioned before, when data gets overwritten, then it's permanently destroyed. So there are a whole range of wiping programs out there available. And basically what they do is they go to the disk and they start writing zeros or different characters across the drive. And once that information has been overwritten, it can't be recovered. Well, actually, it can be recovered, but what you're recovering is zeros.
Graham, it's Graham here. What happens if the Recover My File software doesn't bring back the data you're looking for? What if the drive's making a strange sound or something like that? Is there anything that can still be done after that to get data back?
In some cases it is a hardware problem. You can try the software. If the software hasn't worked for you, then with Recover My Files, the idea is you try it, you see what it can recover, and then if you've located the documents you're looking for, then you can purchase the activation key and save the files. Now, obviously, if the drive's got mechanical errors and the computer can't see the hard drive, then that's where you've got to make the decision, okay, do I want to go out to a data recovery service company and send them my physical drive and have them pull it apart and see what data can come back? Now, obviously, that's more of a time-consuming and a more expensive option. But we do that for our customers. If our data recovery software solution doesn't work for them, then we partner with some hardware data recovery service people who can do the pulling apart of drives.
Data can be stored on other things apart from the old magnetic hard drive, such as flash memory and chips in our phones and things like that. What happens then? Because we're not talking about ones and zeros stored on a drive. We're talking about information stored in flash memory. If you accidentally erase that, I would have thought that'd be gone. Is that the case, Graham?
Yeah, look, there's hundreds of different types of storage devices out there these days. Our software, we have recovermyfiles.com, is developed for computer hard drives. We have a separate product called Recover My Photos, which can be downloaded from recovermyphotos.com, and that really looks after that whole range of digital photograph storage media. If you're talking about a chip, an EEPROM that's programmed into a phone, then that's a completely different specialised field. There is still, it's still possible to get some information off in those circumstances. For example, law enforcement agencies are developing techniques to extract information from chips out of mobile phones, for example, for obvious investigation reasons. So it can be done, but it's a much more specialised field, and it really requires you to send that EEPROM to a specialised service provider.
Now, talking of flash memory and USB devices and so on, you said earlier that one of the important things is not to change the drive that you're trying to recover the software from. So if you've deleted files on your C drive, the last thing you want to do is install a new program on your C drive. Would it be advisable to download Recover My Files to a USB stick or something like that and install it there to recover the data from your C drive?
You don't want to overwrite something,
You don't want to overwrite your photos with the recovery program. That's not going to help you.
Yeah, look, that's certainly an option. You really have to weigh up your situation. Many people accidentally format their hard drive. They've lost all their data. They need to get access to it, so they reinstall Windows. Now, Windows has a footprint of, 300 or 400 megabytes, depending on which version and which options you install. Now, if you're downloading Recover My Files, it only has a footprint of 10 megabytes. So in comparison, really, the risk is quite small. But if you want to follow best procedure, then yes, you should take every opportunity that you have to reduce the risk of writing to that drive. And that means not using Windows and not installing software to it. So usually, if you want to really take the best course of attack, the best thing is to remove that storage device and then connect it to another computer as a secondary drive. And that really reduces the chance of allowing Windows to write to the drive. Reduces the chance of the user accidentally writing to the drive, and allows you to run all your data recovery software and procedures from the good computer's C drive, if you like.
Generation Y, Graham, obviously they're into iPods and the likes. Music would obviously play a fairly large part of their life, and as a result, I guess more and more of us are heading off to iTunes and those sort of environments where they only let you really download the track once when you pay for it. What happens if you've got your life savings worth of kids spend a lot of money on music these days. What happens when the iPod comes to grief or something like that? Can we retrieve information, or is there a way of getting that back?
Yeah, look, about 18 months ago, or probably nearly 2 years ago, we started getting inundated with people trying to recover their songs from their iPod. Now, Recover My Files, which is our main program, does it, but we specifically went out and wrote a program called Recover My iPod. which you can find at recovermyipod.com. And that program is purely to enable users to get back their music from a failed iPod. Again, there's different scenarios when the iPod fails. A lot of the time, people accidentally sync an empty library to their iPod full of songs, which means they all disappear. In that instance, they can be quite easily recovered. But there's also there's the componentry between the iPod casing and the actual hard drive inside, and we accept quite a lot of iPods into our office, and you find a lot of sand in them when people take them to the beach, for example. There's all sorts of scenarios. A lot of them end up in the bath or get submerged. But the hard drive inside an iPod is usually quite... they've got a lot of tolerance, and they're usually in pretty good condition. So probably at least 95% of the time we're successful in getting all the data off an iPod.
It's funny hearing about the sand. I was thinking about
finding
crumbs and Vegemite sandwich crusts inside the VCR and things like that when you pull that apart for repairs. I was going to ask you, Graham, about the resilience, I guess, of different types of storage media. We're seeing storage when it comes to hard disks, for example, like just going through the roof. Like I can remember when I had my first computer, which was probably coming up to... a few years ago now, 20 years ago, we had 20...
That's it on the desk in front of you,
It is. It's spot on. We had like 20 megabyte hard disks and 40 megabyte hard disks, and a friend of mine got an 80 megabyte hard disk, and we all said, what do you want 80 megabytes for? I'm just wondering, as this technology is getting smaller and smaller and our storage capacity is ever increasing, are you noticing an increase in the number of like warranty returns, the number of failures on discs, or has the market really matured and you think that maybe they're as good as they're ever going to be, these sorts of devices?
I think generally, from my own experience, the hard drive storage devices have actually got better over time. In the last 10 years, they're a lot more reliable than they ever were, even of the sizes that have got out to 1 gigabyte. However, you do find those devices used in... there's a lot of external drives, for example, where you plug in via a USB. Now, the external drives, they run the FAT32's file system, which can be a bit more unstable when you get the larger drives. But also, because they're external, they're more prone to be knocked, bumped, dropped, spilt on, and all sorts of other strange things. Or you get some sort of connection error where the connection has upset the file system. So generally speaking, the physical components are a lot better than they used to be, but still, there's many ways to lose your data.
Yeah, they're a lot more shockproof, I guess, and you can certainly, as you say, you can kick them around a lot more than you used to. We always used to have to stand disks up the right way and have computer towers standing up the right way, or sometimes the disks would start to fail and do strange things, but they're pretty resilient these days, I guess.
Yeah, there was also a period where drives started increasing in speed, and they were actually getting quite hot. And they've really worked out a lot more of the cooling systems around a hard drive these days too, which can, you know, increase their reliability long term.
What about RAID arrays and things like that? Obviously, businesses would potentially use those, Graham. Now, if you're not running a RAID as a backup system, but if you're running it to increase your hard drive capacity to speed processes up, can you recover if something goes wrong on one particular drive or something like that? Can you recover from that sort of dilemma?
Yeah, look, RAID arrays can be recovered. There's techniques and software out there available to do it. Recover My Files doesn't currently do it, but our next version will specifically address that issue because we get a lot of requests to recover failed RAID arrays, particularly when you have a redundancy on one drive and you have more than one drive fail at a time. But a RAID array, it's very possible to get the data back. It makes it more complicated because a single file can be split up over two or three or four or five drives in order to get the speed. So it's a matter about getting all those drives talking to each other properly so that you can manage to pick up those pieces of the individual file and then recover the data.
I was just going to ask, Graham, if you could explain in simple terms what a RAID array is, but I think you've covered it there. It's essentially a data being distributed across more than one drive. Is that something that's cost-effective now for small business, or is it still very much in the hundreds of thousands of dollars investment area?
Oh, look, you can buy very large hard drives for very little cost these days. So having a backup, really, you know, it's quite an easy solution. You can buy a terabyte hard drive quite cheaply, and really, if you're filling up a terabyte full of user-created data, then you've obviously got some people who are doing a lot of work for you, because that's actually a considerable effort. So, you know, that's often the case.
One of the things I've always thought, the higher you fly, the further you fall when it comes to disk storage. And I really do think that the simplest and easiest thing for looking after your data is make a copy of it, back it up somewhere. It'll save you all the heartache. But my question, Graham, is all backup software the same? Like, is there some better than others? Like, if you buy a $50 piece as opposed to a $5,000 piece, are you really seeing that much difference in the technology that where those vendors are providing to recover data?
Yeah, look, when you're spending a lot of money on backup software, you're really doing it for having redundant systems. So you're able to, you know, you've got an office environment, say, and the office environment is not disturbed in any way and just keeps working as they go, and the backup is taken seamlessly, and if there's a disaster of some sort, then that backup can be seamlessly integrated back into the workplace. Now, that's why you spend a lot of money. So it really depends, you know, on what you're trying to address. If you're a home user or a small business, then, yes, there's very cheap and very, very effective software solutions out there. The thing you have to be really careful of is that because there are so many players in the backup industry, you've got, when you're looking at software to create a backup, you have to look at flexibility. You have to think about whether that company is going to be around in a few years' time. You don't want to have a situation where you've got a file format where it's not supported anymore, so you've struggled to get the data out of that. So flexibility, conversion of your backup file format into other formats, and really, if you create it, can I get it back easily?
We've been talking on the program a bit about operating systems other than Windows. We've got a Macintosh notebook in the studio now. We've got a notebook in here even running Linux. Operating systems other than Windows, are they just as easy to recover data from when there's a failure?
Well, it's specialised software. Again, our new version of Recover My Files, which is coming out towards the end of this year, will address the Macintosh file system. Now, Macs, while you have Windows computers that are formatted with FAT32 and NTFS operating systems, you get a file system called HPFS on Macintoshes. Yep. So it's just the way that the Mac computer understands the drive. So you need software that knows how to read that file system in order to try and recover the deleted files. But one of the things that Recover My Files does, one of the search capabilities that it has, is that it can ignore all the operating system information, and it can just search across the hard drive. And when you have a file like a Word document, for example, that Word document has a file structure, which essentially means that at the start of the file is specific characters, so they all start a certain way, and basically they all end a certain way. So when you get right down to the lowest level of data recovery, what you can do is scan across a hard drive and then identify some data on a disk and recognize the header, the structure, and the footer, and then chop that piece of data off the drive and say, is this a Word file or a JPEG or a TIFF or whatever file type you're analyzing? And that really means that you can recover a specific file type of any type of file system.
I've got a really dumb question, only because I know my parents would fit this category. They have 3.5-inch floppies still. Remember those hideous things? Chances are it's not even going to read in a drive these days. Can Recover My Files actually look at a floppy out of curiosity?
Yes. It'll look at any drive connected to your computer. So as long as you connect something and it can see it as a drive letter, then you can examine it. And you have to be very careful with those things because, you know, they're very old now, and you might be able to read it once, but generally sending the read head across the drive, you know, you're probably going places that haven't been gone to for quite a long time. So they can fail at those, you know, these old, very old types of media quite easily.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, your website, getdata.com.au, I think it is. I'm looking at recovermyipod.com at the moment. You can download the trial versions there. Obviously, they work for a bit.
I like this feature of it, of being able to download the trial version to see if it's going to work before you pay for it. That's a great idea.
It's good, isn't it? I was just sort of thinking the same thing, because normally you come to sites like yours, Graham, when something terrible happens. So
yes.
What happens? You come to your site, you download. What would you recommend a user do straight after that?
Yeah, look, our main website is getdata.com. We, whilst we love selling software to Australians, it's really only a small percentage of our market. Most of our software is sold either in the US or in Europe, which is, I guess, is the wonders of doing business on the internet these days. You come to our software. Our main page is actually getdata.com. But you can go to one of the products, recover my files, recover my photos, recover my iPod, etc. Download the software. Well, first of all, you have to assess your situation, and are you going to go through the process of taking that hard drive and connecting it to another computer, or are you going to take the slight risk of downloading, installing the software onto that particular drive? So just stay calm, evaluate the situation, download the software, install it, run it, and depending on what type of search you're doing and what type of recovery you're trying to get your data back from, whether it's a deletion or a format or some other drive problem, you'll run it, and then in the results screen you'll see a list of files and folders, and you can go through and you can preview, click on individual files and preview them. Now, I'll be the first to tell you, data recovery, it's no exact science. You don't know what's on the drive and what can be recovered until you look. You may have somehow managed to overwrite and destroy everything, in which case nothing will come back. So it's important that you use our software to preview. And once you can see the information you're looking for and confident that it's there and it can be recovered, then you can go back to our website and you can purchase an activation key, which is sent to you straight away. And then all you do really is enter the activation key into the program, and that gives you the ability to save the files. And again, you have to save the files out to a different drive so that you're not writing the data back to that problem drive. Because of my background, as you mentioned, I came out of law enforcement in police. Our whole mentality was, if you're looking at someone's hard drive, you don't change the contents of it in any way. And we really carried that through in our data recovery software. So if it's not the solution for you and it doesn't work, then you haven't changed it anyway, and you're free to go and pursue other means.
Absolutely. I think that's a real key point, isn't it? And I think you mentioned it earlier, Graham, says he, looking across the panel, in respect to the fact that you don't want to be writing over the stuff you're trying to recover in an earlier sort of effort. So, Graham, it's been absolutely fantastic talking. I've learned a lot, and hopefully some of the listeners have also realised, oh, that's not too bad, because we all do, everyone. It's like a car crash, as Dr. Ron said. You do have that sinking feeling when you boot it up and it says net loader can't be found and all those sort of things.
Invalid boot sector. Yeah, that's as much as you get.
Yeah. So, look, thank you very much for being on the show this evening and just telling us a little bit about the wares and sort of, in a lot of respects, just sort of how easy it is to do. Everything is easy when you know how, isn't it?
That's right. It's a bit of knowledge is a wonderful thing.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you once again. That's Graham Henley from GetData.com, Get Data Proprietary Limited, an Australian company who are developing software
selling to the world, which is a wonderful thing.
Which
I
is
love
good.
Those stories.
It's nice to see Australians actually exporting software and data rather than selling it all overseas and heading over there. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And, of course, as you'd expect with an audio engineer in the studio, the show has started already here, and we're going to turn the microphones on now. You can hear what we're talking about. Anyway, welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, and JD here in the studio this evening, and we're being joined right now by Michael Kamian, who runs an audio post-production facility in Melbourne, and no stranger to Tech Talk Radio. He has been in here before, so we can ask him all the questions that we didn't get to ask last time round, and add a few new ones to the mix in relation to digital TV and surround sound and all those sorts of good things that were no doubt sort of plaguing a lot of home theatre enthusiasts at this point in time. Michael, welcome to Tech Talk Radio again.
Thank you. Once every 2 years is obviously enough for you guys.
Ah, this is good. So what's happened in 2 years? Have we seen any great new innovations come through, or are we just doing things minorly differently, or what's happening in the last 2 years?
Well, I suppose we're starting to use some of the newer technologies more fully.
Are we?
Probably what I would say. It's just that Particularly with television, you know, there's been much carry on about the 5.1 and all that sort of thing. But really, there's very little, you know, let's get real here, outside of the feature film that comes up, which has a massive budget and therefore can afford to do those sort of surround things. When it comes to the stations, it's a massive problem to deal with all that.
It's a very expensive process doing that sort of mix, isn't it?
It is, and it's also a much longer process because you have to think about things. I mean, just think for a moment about a drama where you do a reverse over-the-shoulder shot, and we've got the fridge in the kitchen. You know, we're standing in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. The fridge has gone from the left-hand corner to the right-hand back corner. Now, do we switch that around every time we do a reverse shot? Do you think that's going to be slightly distracting for the audience, or do we keep it in one spot and work out a sort of a vague centre of where this should be in the signal?
Well, depending on the budget, drop it all together.
Oh, yes, exactly. But all I'm saying is you have to think about things much more deeply when you start going surround in terms of where things are, or you have to take a simple approach, which is to give 10% of the sound to the back channels in terms of your Tweety Birds and things like that, so that two things, it's not distracting, and secondly, with an average production, it comes in at a reasonable budget and you can do it on a weekly basis and then just spot certain things to other channels.
Michael, is there content at the moment which is being made in surround sound specifically for television, or is it still mainly...
Do you mix for telly, I think?
Yeah, is it still mainly movies that
it's still mainly movies. Yeah. I mean, it's, as I say, it's a massive extension. To be honest, I don't think even a lot of the clients understand that. Mm. How much more is involved once you go to 5.1 or 7.1 or whatever you like? It's just a massive bigger path. I mean, that's why Dolby quite rightly came out with Dolby E. When was that? It's a few years ago now. I think I was actually at the launch in the US, strangely enough.
Gee.
So it's a while ago, but we won't go into that. But what was I going to say?
Dolby E,
thank you, get me back on track, was designed largely because they realised that stations couldn't afford to put the infrastructure in for all those extra channels. So Dolby E was a clever data compression to fit all that and more information down a standard stereo set of conductors that the most stations would have as their normal routing around the place. So even analog, you know, plugging would be able to carry this.
Because when I hear the word Dolby, I automatically think 10, 15, 20 years ago it was
a cassette player.
Yeah, it was a noise reduction technology. It was synonymous with noise reduction, now, so Dolby E is a way of compressing audio. Yeah,
there will be Dolby A to Z if they have their way
right,
over the years.
Right.
But yes, there has been they've gone through a few letters and a lot of domestic standards and a lot of commercial standards in noise reduction, but they're a smart company and they've looked at all these other things. I mean, Dolby AC3 is a data compression, not a multi-channel situation, which is what most people think.
Now, AC3 is what we have on DVDs, isn't it? That's where we get the
correct
all
it
the
is,
surround
it, but
information.
It is basically just a data compression and it is not lossless. And it was used in studios like this for quite a few years before it was ever conceived of in these terms as a straight stereo format for using on cart machines and things to fire off quickly to air. And a very good system, still used in a lot of stations for the music that turns up in the news, things like that. But then, of course, it's been used more completely now. But this is what Dolby E is. It's a very smart compression. Don't ask me to go too far into this because I don't understand it that much myself, but I can tell you that it will take about 10 generations. That's what they say, and probably a lot more, but you know that's what they're willing to bet on without any real loss.
What do you mean by 10 generations without loss?
That means, in a station, you see, you're copying things, although they're becoming more tapeless all the time. They are going through tape from time to time, or they're assembling reels that will have advertisements and things like that. So they take programs, they want to put them into promotions, they want to do things like that, so they get copied back.
So you mean
forth.
It decodes it back to its audio format and then re-encodes it again at the other end? Is that
oh,
right?
Okay.
Well, if you've got enough Dolby units in the place it does, and that's the one issue with it, is that it does actually delay things 2 frames when they do that, so everything's passing around out of sync.
Oh, good.
And you've got to pull things back into sync, you've got to decode.
Digital television's full of sync issues, isn't it?
Well, it is. We all know that. I mean, I don't know how many people have said, why are the stations all out of sync now? And I say, what have you got? And they said, well, I bought a cheap plasma. And you go, all right, I'll walk away from this now, because immediately you know that the lag time on that is adding to the system. And
that's a good question, actually. We were going to talk about some domestic stuff, and let's just conclude with the Dolby E. So Dolby E is a technology which is really used in the broadcast world.
Yes. It's not for you guys out there.
It's not a domestic user.
You'll never touch it. Do not worry about that 2 frames. That is something that is a bit of a headache for the stations, but it's still better than trying to lay miles and miles of discrete cable to deal with all this.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned 2 other technologies back there before. Dolby, 5.1 and 7.1. Just briefly, tell us what the difference is between 5.1 and 7.1 is.
A couple of speakers.
That's brief. That's good.
Basically, I mean, what can I say? How many ears have you got?
Both surround sound systems.
They're surround sound systems, and I mean, it's like anything else. What are we going to push this year? I'm sorry, guys, but, you know, I mean, if you like 7 speakers decorating your room, good on you. And if you've got the place to put them and the seats that'll fit around them, and you've got the theatre room, that's fantastic. And it will give you a greater spatial effect, I guess, but how many people actually use it, particularly in terms of mixing, is not a lot, because, you're making things more complex. It's really the realm of feature film. And it's not going to turn up much in other things.
So if I've got my 5.1 system at home, I've got my speaker right on top of the screen, I've got the speaker either side, and I've got 2 speakers behind me.
You've got a lot of speakers, yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah. And then I go from 5 to 7. Where do the other 2 go?
Exactly.
No,
they are just part of the chain around the room. You just break your surround down into smaller bits, basically.
So there's four speakers around the back
channels, but they're side back channels, if you like. You're just breaking. You can keep going down this path to 9.1 to whatever, right? You're just dividing up. It's like pixels, you know.
Okay. Yep. More choices.
And how many more birds do you want on separate channels around you?
Is there any content made for 7 surround channels? Or?
I think there is some, but it's
not
only,
much.
But not much at the moment. It's as I say, it's features that would be passed on to this. And I mean, look, I have no figures to say that this is so, but I would imagine, because in an expensive feature, they might remix things several times, one for your DVD or Blu-ray, one for the theatre, and one for there's a whole different spectrum they worry about in all of these things, you see, and one for television.
Mm. But if you're watching the Channel 9 news at 6 p.m, you're not going to get a great advantage running 7.1 over 5.1 in
LA. But actually, you've hit the one point where the broadcasters will shine. If they do a live broadcast, that is where they can use their 5.1 effectively, because instead of this process that you have at the moment with anything post-produced, where you have to keep re-recording and re-recording and then making mixes for all these things, which is what holds the whole thing up and makes it impractical for a lot of productions. When it comes to a major live broadcast, after they've actually gone round, set up all the microphones and sorted that out,
for
a Logies or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Once they've set it up, it is basically open a group on the desk and it's all there, you see. So it doesn't matter how many times you cut between cameras and things like that, they can actually have that field set up properly.
It'd be great for the golf, don't you think? You'd get a bird loop in the background going tweet, tweet, tweet.
Yes, and somebody chasing the ball with a radio.
I've noticed this at the football, where the crowd noise is coming out of the rear channels and that sort of stuff.
So. Well, I've had some classic disasters with that, as you're probably aware, when they first tried this out a few years ago, when they put the mics a bit too close to some of the members of the audience.
Yeah, who'd had the
odd beverage and who had a few extra comments to make about the umpire before they threw the can at them.
But yeah, thinking about television, digital television, and the bandwidth that comes down to your TV in your lounge room, Michael, is this going to impact on the bandwidth that's available for the video?
Yes, absolutely.
So my pictures at the moment are going to look even grungier and even more pixelated on our supposedly high-def channels.
No. It is as is. I mean, it's allocated. They're not going to change that.
Oh, so there's a fixed bandwidth for the audio is separate from the video. They can't. Putting a 7.1 sound channel on it isn't.
Well, they would
steal
have to work some other,
from the video.
Don't say it's beyond the realm of possibility, but I'm just saying yes, they've got their allocated area. They will not muck around with that. So
interesting. That's good to know.
Mm. As long as they don't muck around with it, I think that's the key to it, isn't it? And as long as they use it wisely out there, and they don't give absolutely, you know, consumers all these sounds and all sorts of strange things. Which, hey, it's a new toy. I remember because speaking from video, when we used to get all the, you know, video effects units come out, which we could use on air. Hey, you know, oh, guess who's got one of those? You can see silly things happening on the screen. Hopefully, they don't go the same way with sound and have all sorts of funny things popping out the back speakers and things.
I know. Well, the thing is, they will do exactly what people want. I mean, the whole point of having a 5.1, 7.1 and all that sort of thing is related to the folks out there, basically. If they want to go down the path of special effects and there's a big market for that, then that all makes sense because you're going to pick films that have helicopters blowing up in this side and, you know, spaceships flying across the back. If you like watching sensitive foreign drama... that might run at the Rivoli, you're not really going to achieve much with that setup.
But it's like any technology, isn't it? I mean, when we first got stereo records, there were certain bands that put the music all in one channel and the voices
early
all
Beatles,
in the other
still
channel.
Beatles.
Early stereo
bring
Beatles
the original
the
recordings
classic.
Out. You know, that's McCartney's right. over that side and Lennon's over that side singing through a pickup on his guitar.
That's right. And and then when... you know, colour TV came out and everybody went and bought a colour TV and they grabbed that colour control and they slid it all the way across to the right.
Ooh,
so
yes.
that the brightness, so that the colours were outrageous. And,
they
and,
still do
and
that out of the box when you buy your plasma. What do you mean?
Absolutely.
When they used to, they still do.
But now, you know, we've got stereo recordings that sound more reasonable. We've got televisions that produce more realistic
which
colour.
Which makes you wonder why people want 5.1 for their standard music listening anyway, because if you go for reasonable with any band... that normally stands in front of you, I'm not quite sure what the content is coming out of the back other than the audience and the beer cans again.
Well, for some sort of recordings, that's appropriate.
It
I suppose,
is,
but...
absolutely. But all I'm saying is yeah, that there are still... horses, yeah. I always get back to the fact that please people remember that the left and right speakers are the most important one if you're going to use the system for music because that is actually the image you're most concerned with and the rest will actually confuse in a normal music. Once again, unless you listen to 100% digitally... generated stuff, in which case ping pong bing around the room is what you want. And that's fine. But I'm just saying, for those who are after, you know, the real affair with some small group, they're actually better off spending a lot of money on those two front speakers.
And not worry, and use the old cheap speakers at the back.
Pretty much, yeah.
Fair enough.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about, I guess, home theatre stuff, plasmas, which Michael alluded to earlier, and audio delays and plasmas. Why you shouldn't buy a cheap one, I guess, is going to be the answer to the question. And all sorts of other audio things after this.
Compelling.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Judicious.
The question is really whether young people particularly are addicted to being connected to other people all the time.
Historical.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history. This is the day, the 6th of October, 2006, that life in Australia will be changed forever.
Caring.
I know as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school. How can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
You heard of road rage? What about web rage?
They should be wearing a mask and carrying a gun.
Relations between Telstra and the federal government have been extremely strained almost from the moment Sol Trujillo became chief executive.
Optus had, again, had quite a good quarter, but its 3G service is very low profile at the moment.
And the Queen's got an iPod.
Betty's got one.
Yeah.
I wonder what she listens to. She'll probably listen to us.
An unexpectedly high number of voters swamped the system. Well, what did they expect?
Controversial.
Less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog?
Magical.
And I've got some residual powers.
Ambitious.
High-speed broadband, it's available in most of Asia as well as being in the rest of the world. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
Religion.
Talking for the Roman Catholics, I have been on Vatican Radio.
Comedy.
You put the date on E-Pray, and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
It goes...
Insightful, entertaining and informative. Tech Talk Radio. More than just technology.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
The Panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, JD, and Michael Kamean in this evening. Michael's an audio engineer with Audacious Productions in Melbourne. And he mixes television commercials and television programs and all that sort of stuff, and does a lot of mine, actually. Just to that's why he's here in the studio with us this evening. He even mixed some of the promos that you've heard going to air on this.
You said you were going to pay the bill after this, didn't you?
I did, absolutely. Yes. Do I owe you money? Okay, good. Let's talk about plasma displays, because you mentioned it before. Audio and these sort of devices, is there really a delay in them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just as you will see listed in your everyday listing in the Green Guide or wherever, with all the screens vary.
Mm-hmm.
The screens you buy as televisions do exactly the same thing. They can be quite slow. They can be 12 millisecond delays.
And that's adding a lot.
Yeah, and you can
nearly quarter of a second, a bit less than quarter of a second.
And when you add that into an imperfect system like television as it is, because it's just a natural fact that things get bounced around on satellites and go through all sorts of processes to get to air. And there are, despite, in fairness to the networks, their best efforts most of the time to keep things in sync, things creep in, particularly when you get them from strange sources overseas where they don't care, and an extra frame store in the line which delays something.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, rhetorical thing. Each little bit adds to the compounds the issue, doesn't it?
Exactly.
And Michael, you're talking about a delay between the actual
lip sync
audio and the video.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Sorry, delay. Sorry. I'm not making this clear, am I? A delay between sound and pictures. Sometimes it's one way and sometimes it's the other.
I thought it was just me, my brain getting old and wearing out.
But oh, there that
is
as well.
I thought it was. But there is a real delay there as well.
Yes, absolutely.
That's what I like about radio. So what you can't tell.
And it's thrown a loop with one. Well, it has a few times when people leapt on the technology before they realised too. Including a couple of television stations that actually outfitted themselves almost completely with plasmas when they first came out, and then discovered the issue because nobody was talking about it, particularly the manufacturers.
So the delay can be affected even by the screen at the very end of the process. Your screen hanging up in your lounge room can have a delay.
Yes, absolutely.
That's a bit scary.
So therefore, in actual fact, I hate to tell you this, but you were better off with the CRT in terms of delay, because that was what the system was set up for.
Somebody in this studio continually tells me that CRTs are better.
Well, there's, you know, we're still will get there, but as you are well aware, you still see jitter and things even on the big screens when things move across, and that's, you know, all to do with it too. But we're talking about sound relationship here in particular, and that, yes, that can be well out, and that's why they're advertising now more and more, now that they're getting confident, we've only got a 4-millisecond delay or a 2-millisecond delay, because they've caught up now, or they're trying to. But certainly, it's the old thing of you get what you pay for.
So cheap is not necessarily good for audio in a plasma or an LCD.
Just the same as it isn't with the pictures, it's the same. Yes, with the audio.
So, Michael, is the delay standard? Like, is it preset? Is it 12 milliseconds across the board for one particular screen? Or can it vary according to the compression?
I'm sorry. I see what you're saying.
So if I'm setting up the delay in my TV and I say 20 milliseconds,
absolutely.
That will always work?
Or? You're quite correct. If you've got particularly most of the surround systems come with that delay arrangement, yes, if the better ones do anyway, for the whole set of channels, for setting the relationship. And yes, if you knew the delay, if you could read it off your instructions that came with the set, yes, you could delay the system to come back into sync.
So just dial it up until the lip sync's right.
Yes, yes. In fact, I remember very early on in a tie-up with a fairly upmarket hi-fi place I used to do some things for, but he's not paying for the advertising, so I won't go there. They were into the big screens very early on, and a lot of this problem was happening with the early setups, and they were actually bringing in little separate delay line boxes that they were sitting in each channel and dialing them up. Goodness. To get everything into line.
So tell me about the hardware these days. Obviously, there's cheap stuff out there in the market.
Yeah.
You see them in some of the magazines and local newspapers for surround sound system for $600.
Yeah.
And then you see the other end of the equation, surround sound systems for $6,000 or $10,000. Surely there's a fairly sizable difference in what you pay for in those sort of environments.
Yeah, I mean, it's like all these things, there is a sort of a diminishing return for your money, I guess.
So what's good to pay these days? What would you pay for a reasonable system?
Depends what you call reasonable. If you mean something that's an extension off the kitchen or something for your home theatre.
Well, if you look at it this way, people are spending $2,000, $3,000 on a plasma. If you're going to spend that amount of money on a big screen, you've got to be proportionally spending that sort of money on a surround system.
You haven't even entered the real world of hi-fi, have you?
No.
No.
I've got no idea. How much?
Guys, you can spend $15,000 on a set of front speakers.
Fantastic. Where do I sign up?
Yeah. And they'll be fantastic.
But actually, the Tech Talk Radio's next competition after the Maxtor Drive will be a $15,000. No, I won't. I'm only joking.
That's good.
But there are some massive... to be honest, I can't keep pace with the rate of change in the amplifier units at the moment. In 12 months, the number of updates that are being brought out in these systems... I mean, the latest ones in the really upmarket surround amplifiers set themselves up, basically. They don't just run the white noise and the pink noise now, but they listen back to everything. They get the right delay between things. They set it up. You just set it up, run.
All right. You've just opened up Pandora's box now. What's white noise and what's pink noise?
They're just a different equalization of noise. One is related to the pink noise is related to the sensitivity to different frequencies in the ear. So in other words, it's proportional noise to different frequencies, whereas the other is just the same power coming out at all frequencies.
Okay.
Does that make any sense?
It sort of does. So the older you get, the less pink you get. Is that right?
Well...
Because your hearing falls off and all that.
Well, the pink noise is more relevant.
Is it?
Really.
It's what you hear?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's like this, older sound mixers, you tend to ride the highs a bit higher.
Oh, because their natural hearing has fallen off a little bit.
Correct.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know. Cameramen like that, they wear glasses.
Mm.
It's good, isn't it?
Yes.
Michael, I'm looking at installing a new surround sound system at home.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on wired speakers versus wireless speakers?
I'd always take wired first if I had the option.
There's a lot of packages that we're seeing now which offer the wireless solution and seems at face value to be a good idea if you don't want to be drilling holes in walls.
Absolutely. I mean, all these things are always a trade-off. And once again, you get what you pay for. It's like wireless headphones. You can buy some great wireless headphones, but if you walk into a store and buy the $25 special hanging off the front, they'll be rubbish.
Mm.
And there's plenty of them out there too. They're designed to look like the things you're wearing, Sennheisers. There you are. Got to plug it. But they're not a scratch on them. But people still buy them. They say, look, it must be all right. It looks like the Sennheiser.
The wireless ones still need to be powered, though.
Yes.
Is that usually like with a? I haven't ever set one.
Yeah,
one of these systems up. Do you need a plug pack per speaker, or are they battery powered? How are they usually powered?
I don't think you'd be running a battery pack on to power a speaker. I think you'd be plugging it in.
So you're still going to need a power point anyway near every speaker.
Yeah.
So
it defeats the purpose.
It does,
really,
doesn't it? You're still running cables there.
Yeah.
And it's another unpredictable delay in your sound too to get it on and off the wireless channel. Yeah.
I'm more concerned at the moment with the worrying number of queries I've had about what type of speaker is a good quality one in the ones that actually flush mount in the walls. And the answer to that is none.
Really? People asking you that question?
Yes. I'm surprised in this day and age that people still haven't got the message that speakers that are mounted into the walls, as in flush-mounted, like you would see in an elevator.
My parents have got
that's
some of
what
these
they
the
sound
roof.
Like, an elevator.
Why is that?
Because any good speaker, what's the first thing you notice about it?
Needs an enclosure, doesn't it?
Well, it's a function of the sound. Yes, it's tuned. It is a part of the whole process. So although there are... as in anything else, these wall mount ones, there are some better ones. LTEC make ones which are obviously better than some of the others. And there are some, better. But when it comes down to comparing that with the box speaker, no comparison. Because the box, for a start, it's a point source. The sound travels off the surface and gives you an image. The moment you flush mount it on the wall, everything's just traveling along the wall and connecting to the next speaker. So you just get this mishmash, no image. You're ruining the image of the sound, basically, and you end up sounding like a hotel foyer.
I guess people are trying to be clever and they're trying to design their own home cinemas, and they're thinking, well, I've got the nice big screen there, I'll flash mount the speakers, it'll look really nice.
Cinemas like don't flash mount their speakers. They have
they actually
have large carpeted areas or screened areas that look like solid walls, but they're not, and there's actually speaker boxes behind there.
Mm.
Well, if you walk into any,
curtains and things,
any of the cinemas, they've all got their surround things normally a metre off the wall too, haven't they? They sort of stick out there as you bonk your head
they're
on the
focusing the speakers. Yeah.
That's what I love about sound. It's very selfish. You really have to be centering in front before it to work properly, don't you? Unlike television or video in general.
People would like it to be otherwise, but X marks the spot.
It does, doesn't it? You know, you can all fight for the middle seat in the cinema, but there you go.
Mm.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the loudness of TVCs, television commercials for those not in the game. Are they really as loud as you think they are? Well, we'll dispel some of the rumours and fuel others, I think. Heaven help anyone who lives near a prison and wants to use a mobile telephone.
We tend to use that terminology sloppily and it can confuse.
Like a woman scorned.
NAB, web junk. We've got GPS for when you're outside and we've got triangulation when you're inside.
No, I'll do it again later.
That old chestnut.
Let's talk about Goosh.
Though she's not a human, she can act like a real girlfriend.
Informative.
Where are you going to get your iPhone from? Are you going to get a Vodafone one or a Telstra one?
Independent.
10.5's had some problems.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Speaking of nerd conventions.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Dynamic range. It's a wonderful thing. It's, loudness and softness, and there's quite a bit of it in a movie these days. When you put that up against a television commercial, the TV commercials seem louder, according to some people. Is this the case?
I reckon they do. I reckon they're much louder.
Is this the case, Michael?
I'll tell you why I reckon that, because I have to turn the volume down when the commercials come on, because they're louder than the program. But they seem louder.
Uh-huh.
And then I always crank it back up again.
You wouldn't do that, would you, Michael?
Yeah, you have to turn it up to hear the dialogue in the normal program. Yeah,
you do.
Yeah.
You do. My father complains about that all the time.
I'll turn
the subtitles on.
That'll do it.
The subtitles louder? No, sorry.
No, but the braille's violent. sorry, had to get that one in. Listen.
He's being very non-committal,
listen,
isn't he?
Yeah. I got to say, I think the Cowboys were more back in the analog era when it was all analog and there were no agreements or anything. And I used to work in advertising way back then too. And basically, a whole pile of people from an agency, when a commercial was being mixed, would file in to the back of a studio and sit down and the bloke at the front would sweat. And they'd say, louder, 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 and that's what they'd get. They wouldn't understand what they're doing, mind you. I mean, but it was, some studios admit to having a panel of lights they used to turn on to impress people too that had nothing to do with the gear. But it
still do.
But it's, not going there. There certainly was a push to do that until somebody said, stop, enough, and all of that. But just to look at it from another angle, please keep in mind that the stations want the money from the advertisers. They want you to keep watching and listening and don't want you to switch off. So it's not actually in their interests to annoy you to death either.
That's never stopped them before, though.
Well, the situation certainly in analog land was quite clear, and that was that stations have station clippers, which stop everything from rising above a certain level, but they have automated systems below that. Although way back, of course, you used to have a person riding the controls. But the aim of the game is not to push the transmitter into clipping. And the thing about making a commercial subjectively loud is that you crush the dynamics, which means the lowest low is closer to the highest high. Now, when that passes all the people in the middle and gets to the transmitter or in the path to the transmitter, the station clipper takes over and everything rises up to whatever that preset level is. So if the peaks, if I'm not getting too far into things here, the peaks in an ordinary drama are well above the average level because they want to be able to reach that note that'll make you jump. So the average dialogue level and everything, and it's more so in films where you're in a quiet cinema than it is when it's mixed for television, but the same still applies. They keep it at a certain level and so that they can ride it high when they want to for effect. But when you get to the commercial break, they just want you to get it. So certainly back in the analog days, they had woken up to the fact that if you crushed everything up, it would all rise up, quite apart from anything the station wanted to do, because the station clipper would hit normal programming, hold the peaks at a certain level, and all the average sound would be well below that. But when you came to the commercial, it would do the same thing. It would try and hold the peaks there, but the average level was closer to that point. Now, all the monitoring levels and all that also were less sophisticated then, so things got through.
You're really sort of saying that television commercials now seem louder because we turn the lows up to match the highs, so or the loudness, I guess. So when loudness sits at a certain level, which is the legal loudness, we're pulling all of our soft whispers up to meet those loudnesses.
That's not a bad way to put it. That was how it used to work, but because everyone's complained and because the broadcasters have also really not entirely enjoyed the way the commercials were being delivered to them, they've got into an agreement now, which you were actually, if you're supplying a commercial, you actually have to specify that you agree to this before they'll take the commercial.
Yeah, we have to tick the box now. We have to be OP48 compliant.
That is the one. And this is basically a general agreement to keep the subjective loudness of the commercials within a certain range. Because it is it's not like a picture where you've got a cut-off point for the left, the right, the top and the left of the picture and the brightness and all of this sort of thing. Sound is a much harder thing to get a grip on because it's all about spectrum. And which bits you compress and which ones you don't. And it is easier to measure now than it was because we've become more sophisticated about our measuring devices, which are becoming more universal. In fact, there's one that they're looking at to be adopted as a general measuring stick, if you like, in Europe at the moment that will probably come over here in the not-too-distant future and everyone will have to comply to.
That's got to be good. OP48's available at freetvaustralia.com.au for those of you who want to go and have a read on those technically inclined. It was funny, actually. I got some specifications sent across to me the other day from Channel 10, and in eras gone by, the video specifications are normally much more detailed and much more use much more paper than what the audio does. But now it's the other way around. Yeah. The audio specifications go over three or four pieces of paper and video is just one now. Mm.
There's good reasons for that too, is because they're broadcasting in analog, digital and high def, and all of those have got different specifications. So they're trying to keep all that's coming into the station but within the vague area of all of those three so that they don't lose the plot on any of those broadcasts, and so they're much tighter. But I would also like to just a little anecdote here. Anecdote on the fact that a lot of these rules were often broken by people in the on the creative side of the game, if you like, unintentionally too, just because they didn't understand what they were
trying to get
doing.
An effect or something like that.
Yeah, there was one guy I know who will remain unnamed but it wasn't really his fault. He wanted the sound of he was at a studio that was feeding to me and a whole lot of other places on a regular basis, on a daily basis with a commercial. He wanted a sound like old Valve radio. And unfortunately at the studio he was at, he was teamed up with a guy who was a bit, basically a trainee. Maybe they knew something about this guy to give him this guy to work with. But anyway, he kept saying, I want that old Valve sound, you know, with a bit of distortion, a bit grungy and all that sort of thing. Well, there are ways of creating that within a system and still controlling the levels, basically.
So this is like an effect that he wanted on
it
the...
It was an effect he wanted on the recording.
Yeah, he wanted distorted and things.
Yeah, right. that sort of old Valve sort of sound like a radio. And
you do that very well.
Thank you very much. And he got what he wanted, but he got it because the guy didn't understand what he was doing. He just pushed all the faders up until it distorted. And he said, that was great. Now, that's what got taped, which was totally out of all specification. And actually, because he didn't understand, that went off to the stations. Now, the stations refused to play them, and he hit the roof. He was going, you're cutting into my creative, blah, 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 and all this sort of thing. And they had to explain to him what was wrong. So, you know, sometimes it's not like that. And there was another guy who, this applies to me too, who on one occasion rang me up saying, your commercial you mixed for me isn't loud enough. And I said, oh, right, why? And he said, it's just not loud enough. And I said, well, how did you gauge this? And he said, well, you know that VHS copy, it was a while ago, you gave me after we'd finished. I said, yes. And he said, well, I took it home and I set it up in the video and I've got quite a good sound system at home. And I watched and waited for a commercial break. And when all the ads came on, after a few commercials, I quickly pushed over to the VHS and played it. Wasn't as loud.
Yeah, it's not very scientific, Michael.
Well, it was trying to explain
creatives
it to this
scientific,
man.
Scientific, that's the thing.
Yeah. And this was from a major agency. So you've got to realise, you know, sometimes these guys are asking for things they don't know what they're asking for.
Mm.
Michael, it's been an enlightening evening, I guess, talking about all these sort of things. We can go on for hours about audio. It's a very interesting topic and very passionate about it for some people too, especially when you do radio and television for a living. You can certainly talk about things like sound effects and how you place them and things like that. Oh, it's fascinating. But thank you for coming in this evening. Thanks, Rob, for letting you come out tonight, because I know you've probably got a few other things you should be doing. But we've learned a lot. It's been great. Again, we'll have you back in another 2 years.
I was going to say, can you hold the doors up that long? Yes.
All right, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. You've been listening to Michael Cremeen there from Audacious Productions. He is a proprietor of an audio production facility in Melbourne who does lots of TV shows. You fish a bit, you cook a bit, all those sorts of things, and does the odd radio commercial here, there, and everywhere as well.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Windows Server 2008 is a very interesting new bit of technology which Microsoft has put onto the market. It's currently available in its standalone form of Server 2008. And it's reasonably priced for those small enterprises that want to go down the path of getting online from in their office, running a small collaborative environment where you can share all those sort of good things. Coming up very shortly in November, we're going to see the launch of Server 2003 Small Business Server.
Mm.
Now, that's going to be interesting with all their new virtual machine ware and all that sort of stuff which is coming out.
Yeah, I've got several clients using Small Business Server 2003, and so we're looking forward to seeing what Small Business Server 2008 looks like.
Have you seen a beta version, or have you got a build of it yet that you've plugged in
haven't,
and turned on?
Haven't built one yet, no. No, I've read a few things about it. But
people are actually using 2008 as a server, as a workstation, because,
yeah, I've heard this.
Because it's better than Vista, apparently. Oh, who said that?
Mm.
Anyway, let's introduce to the panellists evening, I guess this evening, Simon Pierce from Symbian. Good evening, Simon. Thank you for traversing all the ways through Melbourne's rotten weather to join us this evening.
Good evening. Thanks very much for having me on.
Hey, no worries. Now, tell me a little bit about Symbian and what you do and how Server 2008 helps what you do.
Symbian Health, the part I work in is Symbian Pharmacy Services. We have an application called MinFOS. The MinFOS application is for pharmacies across Australia for brands such as Terry White, Ken Martin, Pharmacy Choice. The application itself is a point of sale, dispensary, warehouse, multi-site and accounting package all in one. So it's a comprehensive end-to-end package that all our brands use.
So do they connect in somehow to you via how? How do they talk to you?
Okay, so basically we have a process that runs every night, collecting the sales information, ordering information from each pharmacy, which is pulled back into the Symbian head office, and we chop the data up. And
okay, so if they run out of tablet A or tablet B or prescription, I don't know, whatever they run out of, they don't even have to contact you. It sort of automatically comes up and you ship them what you think they want.
That's
is that right?
We have predictive ordering, and we also look at their sales. So we compare each Terry White across Australia, Chemmart or Pharmacy Choice, and say, show them how they're doing against each other stores, and where they can improve, what areas are selling, what areas aren't selling. We also have automatic ordering, so they can set and forget ordering, dials into the Symbian head office, and
that's
the order
is there the next
day. That's
got to be handy for chemists, because that's the last thing you want to do.
Correct. So we can look over 12 months, look at seasonal ordering, ordering over a certain period of time, and predict what stock they're going to need.
All right. Now, you've just migrated, I think you said about November last year, from what to Server 2008?
The MinFOS system itself is actually a legacy Novell application, so it actually runs a custom database on a Novell platform. Therein lies the problem. With Novell calling the end of life on the product, we've had to look at our options and what we can do in the future.
So you were forced to change, really?
Pretty much.
And you chose Server 2008. Why?
number of reasons. Number one, support for the other systems in the market.
That'd be pretty important, I think, in today's modern business world, getting someone on the end of the phone when you need, sort of like, hey, what's going on here?
That's correct. We have pharmacies across Australia. So we have pharmacies in Broome, Northern Territory, Western Australia, South Australia, Coober Pedy. To get a Linux technician on site, on some of those, it's near impossible. We have to fly them there. There's just no support available. So that was one of our key concerns.
For getting a Microsoft technician, I guess there's a few more of them around than a Linux one, but you would surely start off with a phone support. Is that even better than, you know, physical on-site support?
That's correct. We have ourselves in Minfos, we all have a level 1 and a level 2 support. We'll do the basic application support, server support where we can. We then have hardware vendors that take care of the operating system on site as well as all the desktop support.
Okay, so your choice was based solely around the fact that you were, had to move away from obsolete or a non-supported platform into a new environment. That in itself, at the scale that you're sort of talking about, would have been fairly daunting.
Correct. So
how long planning? Like, what was this? Sit around and sort of like, oh, boys, is this going to be fun? Or how did it go?
We've been planning over 2.5 years now. So initially, we decided to rewrite the Minfos application database into a Novell platform. Novell then pulled the pin on us and said, sorry, guys, we're not supporting that anymore. Back to the drawing board, what database
engines? That would have gone down well.
Went down very well with the Symbian management. So then again, we had to look at our options for database engines. That's when we chose to move to the Microsoft operating system and the ElevateDB, actually open source SQL engine.
Now, okay, talking a little bit about databases and things like that, do you house all your technology in your own environment, or do you outsource that to some hosting organizations, or how do you do that?
Each pharmacy has its own database server. So across 600 sites, there's 600 instances of database, and we also have our own in-house databases that pull the information back and analyse that information.
And now, do you do this across like a private network, or is it standard TCP IP over the internet?
It's across an IPsec VPN network.
Okay, so relatively secure, I guess. But a server in each chemist?
That's correct.
So that's a big... That's huge.
That's great. Yes.
What made you choose that?
Reliability is number one. We have pharmacists that operate 24/7. If their server's down, they can't trade. With the older technology, there was no database replication. There's nothing like that to sort of for failover. So that's when we started looking at what was available, what was one of the most solid platforms. We invited Novell to come along. We invited Microsoft. Microsoft actually stepped up to the plate and pleasantly surprised us with both support, showing us what their application can do, and then actually allowing us to participate in the RDP program.
Okay. So Novell just didn't want to know about? Is that really what happened, or they...
Pretty much. Yeah. Novell stepped up to the plate and came back to us with an inquiry about why we have so many licenses they can't find. So we weren't very impressed with their overall reaction.
Customer service is fairly important these days, and whether you be a consumer who's got a dodgy iPhone or iPod or something, or a mobile phone, through to when you invest a lot of money in these sort of technologies. But you've rolled out a Windows 2008 server in each particular chemist, and they would then obviously use their cash register, I'm assuming, tell me if I'm wrong, they've hooked up their cash registers, their databases for their customers on there and things like that they do subscriptions.
Basically, what we have, we've got EFT tools, so they're computer tools. It's actually a Toshiba product we're using across Australia. So it's a fully integrated tool module with Windows XP Professional built into it. It actually hooks into the Minfos database, which houses all their customer information.
Interesting that you say XP.
Yes, we don't use Vista that much.
Well, see, that's the thing, isn't it? Because Microsoft have touted that 2003, Server 2003 and XP were, husband and wife. And as a result, when you move to 2008 Server, Vista is supposedly the partner of choice for Server 2008. Yet Service Pack 3, which came out recently for Windows XP, has put a lot of the good things that Vista has into... So you've obviously chosen that for a reason?
Generally, we recommend XP. It does run quicker than Vista. It takes it all the nice little things that we just don't need in there, and it just runs our application straight out of the box.
And you guys sleep a bit better at night.
We certainly do. Absolutely.
I think in a lot of respects, that's why people are still actually choosing to go with the known tiger as the moment. Oh, sorry, that's the wrong company. the known beast out of the box, I guess, compared to the others. All right. Let's go back to the planning process. You've chosen to move from one platform to another. That in itself, to me, would be incredibly daunting, especially when you have chemist livelihoods on the line. How did you go about it, and what sort of redundancy did you do? Did you run systems in parallel for a bit while you tested it out?
That's great.
How did it go?
We initially ran internal tests on the system. So the first thing was to build an actual MinFOS database application that would run the custom database format. So that was the first thing we had to achieve. Once that was achieved, we had to ensure the system reliability and stability of the product. Again, we ran this trial over about 2 months, 2.5 months, and we found that the application ran fairly well, and in some cases ran better than the Novell product. Keep in mind, this application has been around 20 years, so it was originally developed when Novell was the dominant.
So you'd have been fairly comfortable with that product. Yeah, so this is really pushing you out of your comfort zone here,
certainly
wasn't it?
Certainly is, yeah. Yep. Certainly was. From there, we actually moved to 3 in-store trials, one being a Greenfield site, so a complete new MinFOS site running the 2008 server, the second being an upgrade from Windows 2003, and the third being an upgrade from Novell. We basically, our first one was the upgrade from the 2003 server with Terry White Southland. That server went in over a period of about three and a half hours, got the system up and running, and it actually ran flawlessly from day one. No crashes, no speed issues, nothing like that. So we're very...
That's got to be a good result then. So you obviously all slept well going, oh, this is going to work.
I got a lot of sleep that weekend.
So did that mean whilst you were doing the development that you had to run the database in parallel on Novell and Windows?
That's correct. The technology we use actually creates something called a TTS file, which is a record of all the transactions that are created on that data on that database. So if anything went pear-shaped, we actually had the Novell server sitting next to it, and all we need to do is replay that TTS file to bring up to that point in time. So we had a recovery action plan.
How confident were your customers of the... Were they sceptical? Were they, you know, they said, oh, these guys do it right?
No, it was actually well embraced by our customers. A lot of them commented, why haven't you done this sooner? Which was to my surprise.
Well, okay, that's a pleasant response really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's actually even reflected in our sales. Our sales have actually increased a fair proportion over the last... from August last year, since we've announced to all our customers. From the 600 customers Australia-wide, we've had over 35% already convert. With all the major groups in the pharmacy world have committed as well. So it's okay.
Excellent. All right, well, what we might do is we might take a little bit of a break, and we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about this. I know that's a very bold step. In a lot of organisations, not only just moving up a platform in server technology, moving from, say, 2003 to 2008 would be fairly daunting at the best of times, but you've gone completely from one end of the spectrum across to the other, which I think is... It's a fairly bold step. But anyway, it seems to be good. We'll talk a little bit more about it when we come back, just after this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Facebook spam. This is Dr. Ron. Now, what's going on here?
They said that, yeah.
But no one's recorded where that user is.
Well, we don't know that, Graeme.
Yeah. Yeah, well, no.
No?
No.
Oh. You're an anomaly. You're a statistical blip.
Yeah, but they're all city-centric deals, too.
What the worry is, though, it's not always as obvious as that.
Watch this space, wait, see.
The sinister bit is that they've been collecting all this data.
What the hell are they talking about?
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Ah, welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Yes, there was another show going on here in the studio. We thought we better talk. Andrew McComb here.
We often seem to do that.
It happens, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Graeme Callaghan, Justin Dunlop is here. And our guest this evening is Simon Pierce from Symbian. And they've just done the big brave move of changing platforms for their business. And moving from basically rebuilding this whole system from the ground up, as we've just discovered. Simon, how is it so far? Like, what's the reaction from everybody? Are they happy with it? Because you've had to basically start again, haven't you? It's like rebuilding a house.
So we've had to rebuild the application from start. So that means a database transformation as well as an application rebuild.
That in itself is a big job.
Yes, very big.
How many people you got doing this sort of stuff?
It's about 17 at the moment.
Ah, good. They're good friends, I hope. There'd be lots of late nights there, I reckon. Pizzas?
Late nights, pizzas, yeah. Beer sometimes, if we're allowed.
So, obviously, they've been sitting there developing away. Now, what normally goes hand in hand with Microsoft products is their C++ platform .NET. What are you using to write all this stuff in?
We're actually using Ball and Rad Design Studio.
Ah, so you've moved away from the incumbents... they're offering and you're trying something. Is there a reason for that?
That was the choice of the development manager. Not sure of his reasons.
Was it a good choice?
So far, so good.
Okay, well, that's good.
So far, so good. Nothing's broken, so we're happy with that.
Has anything happened that you didn't expect? Have you had any sort of like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do here? Or has it all just been smooth sailing?
It's actually been smooth sailing. I mean, I think when I was talking to you before, the first time I did the Windows installation, I put the set in and it said, you know, come back in 20 minutes. I came back in 20 minutes and it worked. I went, you know, that can't be right. What's wrong? Sure enough, it actually worked. So
don't tell me the actual time it took to install it actually told you correctly.
That is correct.
That's unheard of in computer world, isn't
it? It's unheard of in Microsoft land anyway.
Rather surprising. And, you know, the thing that was the biggest surprise to me was, you know, from the NT 4 days to the 2008, it just worked out of the box. There was no complex setups. The hardest thing we had to do was open a port in the firewall, and our application just ran and worked.
So that's impressive, isn't it?
Just clarify that. 20 minutes from putting the disk into having server 2008 running on a box.
25 minutes.
That would have to be half the time, if not a third of the time, of a 2003 install.
Presumably this is running on some really huge 8-core, you know, 20 gig of RAM.
He's shaking his head. That's not good for radio.
HP ML310.
An ML310.
ML310.
And so that's a perfectly ordinary server like anybody might have in their, any small company might have in their back office.
That's correct.
Did you option it up with anything? Because for those of you who aren't familiar with 2008 server, it's modularized now. It comes with a server core, which is your basic, what you must haves. And then you can plug things into it, like web servers and the likes. Did you add anything to it?
No, basically we installed the core server and the MinFOS server application on top of the Windows 2008 server. So that's what we didn't have to install IIS. We didn't have to install all these other little fancy options that you don't really want and you have to then remove in 2003.
Ah.
So that's what cut down so much time in the installation.
And that'll help with the performance of the machine as well, not running all that extra stuff in background too.
Absolutely.
Mm.
And more importantly, what do your clients think of it? Have you had good reaction? I think we touched briefly on this before, but...
I've had no complaints, which says a lot in itself. In the past, if something goes wrong, I certainly know about it. And I have customers on the phone going, you know, I'm trying to run a business here, my server's down, my server's not working. I didn't hear
Well, that's not a nice phone call to get that.
No. I didn't hear from the beta site for 2 weeks and I went... Either What's it's wrong? Broken or he's gone on holiday. I'm not sure which one yet. So I went down for a visit and he was there smiling away saying, I like my new toys.
That's really promising, isn't it, for a new technology rollout? So, all right, let's talk a bit about the cost. Was it an expensive thing to roll out? Because you've gone from one to another and you've had to redevelop your software from the ground up. What about licensing and things like that? How did that
licensing has actually come down from the Novell product. Some of our pharmacies were paying up to $3,000 per year for the licensing rights.
That'd be pretty big for a small pharmacy.
That's huge. Some of the bigger pharmacies, $3,000 a year, that's just money they don't want to spend, and they won't if they don't have to. With the Microsoft product, Microsoft actually came to the party and said, hey, we'll offer you this deal for all your pharmacies, special one-off rate of $1,200, including 5 cows. So we're rather impressed with
a cow. That's a client access license. That means you can have five other terminals talking to your server.
That's correct.
Sorry, Graham, you going to say something?
No, I was going to say exactly that. That's all right.
So it's cheaper and it's faster and appears more reliable from what you were saying.
So far.
So far, so good. All right, well, that's really encouraging, I guess, to a small business who wants to do the migration from 2003 to 2008. So in just recapping what you've said, a lot of the applications that 2003 install, you don't need anymore. So hence the reason why your install time goes down to 20 minutes or something like that. That's fantastic. What about hardware relation? I know you've just touched on what you've installed it on. Is there any sort of warnings or anything like that you give to people or sort of say, oh, make sure you've got plenty of RAM or anything like that when they're installing 2008?
Yeah, we have minimum specification document on our website. So if for all our potential customers, they can actually go on and have a look through that document. So we generally look at a 3 gigahertz processor for our server.
Oh, that's pretty standard these days.
Around 2 gig of RAM and, you know, multiple hard disks.
Yeah. So do you have
specifications
specifications around the brand or the type of video card to cut down on the compatibility problems?
No, we recommend HP products, so the HP ML series. Mm-hmm. We've had minimal issues with those, and as well as any Intel white boxes. We haven't had any problems with drivers, with the system loading or anything like that. It's just come up and worked.
You're installing it on the same hardware that the previous server uses out at the customer site, or are they buying new
cases,
servers?
In some cases, no. It depends on the age of the equipment. If we have servers that are 5 years old and 7 years old, in some cases, we just say, guys, you know, it's time to upgrade. Time to put the hand in the pocket. You know, your Novell server that's been sitting there for 5 years or 7 years just, you know, it won't cut the mustard. So they've then upgraded their hardware. Some of them have done a complete swap over from the old Novell server that they bought 6 months ago to a brand new Novell server.
Windows server. Interesting.
What's the weakest link?
Hopefully not our software.
No, it sounds like it won't be. It's probably more like a connectivity issue, which seems to be everything these days. Someone trips over an extension lead somewhere. Heaven help you if you're in Queensland and you're an Optus customer. You've got two chances of staying in business. Someone will dig a backhoe through it or something like that. But no, seriously.
I think the hardest thing we've had is getting all our customers to the Windows platform, because we have customers which are so diverse. We have some that are more than happy to spend what's required, some that aren't. It's really come down to talking to the people and saying, look, this is something you need to do to look at this new technology. And when we show them what the new application is capable of, they go, oh, wow, okay, we'll change next week.
But also the model of distribution you're using sounds like it's a synced software. So at the client side, so at the pharmacy, they're keeping all their data local and they've probably got it backed up on disk or tape or something locally, and it's batching it all up overnight to the central server. So if you lose your internet connection, okay, you may not get the product that day. You have to suffer some pitfalls from a failure. But the next day it will go up, or as soon as the internet connection's back, it will sync.
That's correct. We have both methods. So we have the automatic internet uploading, and we also have the old dial-up modem. So you can dial up your orders if there's something wrong with the internet and make sure that you can get deliveries.
A fallback to the old dial-up modem. Now, that's romantic, isn't it? So we have to listen to AM radio at the same time while you're doing that. Yeah. Simon, it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you this evening. My last question, how do you rate Server 2008? Are we talking it's a good step forward or it's an amazing step forward? How would you sort of classify it in respect to your business model? Is it doing everything you want for you, or is it surprisingly better?
Probably the key word is surprisingly better. I didn't really have high expectations of the product when I first got it. I thought, here we go again.
Were a cynic when it first came out.
I was a very big cynic. I thought, okay, here's this
stuff. That's why you go to the road shows, really,
isn't
it?
And you're a cynic because of experiences with Server 2003? Or
more Vista product.
Okay. If it's based on Vista, then we'll go
2003. Thank you very much.
Mm.
And very happy with the product when it was released to us. And you know, we sat down with Microsoft and the guys from CAS. It completely changed me from a cynic going, you know, this is not going to work, to I'm actually pleasantly surprised and thought, okay, this is actually possible.
Well, that's good. Hopefully you'll encourage people to make the step into the world of 2008, because it is. It's a big decision for small business, even large businesses to a lot of extent. The relationship between XP, Vista, and the server technology seems to be not an issue. Would you say that?
Vista will probably be the pitfall. Again, I suppose going back to our legacy with Novell, when Vista was launched, it doesn't talk to Novell servers. So that was our first one of our biggest problems. So then we looked at, you know, moving to a 2003 server. Yes, it talked, because you can run TCP/IP between the two client and server applications.
Mm. All right. Well, thanks for giving us an insight on how the Symbian system works and how we get all our chemists talking to one another. I didn't know it was so intricate is probably the word. Simon, thank you very much for your time this evening. I've learned a lot and it's been encouraging for me. I'm quite excited now. I'm going to go load up my demo discs. I'm waiting for 2003 to come out in the server to come out. 2008 server to come out in the
server.
Because that'll be
really looking forward to that one too.
Absolutely good to roll it all out. So, once again, Simon, many thanks for making the journey in this evening.
Thanks
for learned a lot. It's been great.
And that's all we have time for in this week's episode of Tech Talk Radio's summer series. We'll have another big show for you next week, and of course I know you're all looking forward to the return of Andrew, Dr. Ron, Justin and myself to the panel for all new episodes of Tech Talk Radio in February. Remember, you can stay in touch with the team and other listeners using all the usual methods. You'll find everything you need at our website, www.techtalkradio.com.au. I'm Graeme Callaghan, wishing you all the best for another week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron Panlis, Graeme Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graeme Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.